Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. A few years ago, nature lovers began sounding an alarm. Bees were disappearing, and no one was quite sure why. They're tiny, they can sometimes be pesky at outdoor gatherings, and they sting, so why should we care? Well, the simple answer is that bees are pollinators. Without their help, the food supply, our food supply, would begin to dwindle, and that would put us at risk. But bees aren't the only pollinators in the world. There are about 200,000 different species, and about half of those, 100,000, are at risk of extinction. Now, this is serious business and something we need to understand and move toward fixing. Jody Helmer writes about food and farming while tending gardens and keeping bees on a small part of North Carolina. The author of 6 books, her latest is Protecting Pollinators, How to Save the Creatures That Feed Our World, and she joins us here at Spirit Square for the hour. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for us on Facebook at WFAE. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can even watch Jody. I think I'm out of the frame right now on Facebook Live. Okay. So remind us, how long have we known about this slow disappearance, particularly of honeybees?
So honeybee decline, the alarm was sounded in about 2006 when a beekeeper noticed that his bees had disappeared. There was no explanation. His hives had just been abandoned.
And they were empty. No bees, no bee carcasses, nothing.
So what happened was the bee population, most of the bee population took off, and they left frames full of honey and pollen, but they were gone. And so they should have been otherwise healthy hives, and the bees had left. And this beekeeper was the first to sound the alarm, and other beekeepers started coming forward and saying that they were witnessing the same thing in their hives. And that was what was termed colony collapse disorder, and that was first coined in about 2006.
So those bees didn't go elsewhere. They died. Is that right, or do we know?
We don't know.
We don't know.
Mm-mm. Honeybee swarms are fairly common. So if you think about a beehive, they live in that little box, and when they get very crowded, they will swarm.
Sure.
And so the queen will take off, and she will go in search of a new hive elsewhere. And that is very common. It's a sign of a healthy hive. There are all sorts of signs that bees are about to do that. But this was not the case with the colony collapse disorder.
So this one person comes forward and says, all of my bees are gone. And then some other people start stepping forward. Were they stepping forward because they realized, I'm not alone in this, this is happening elsewhere? Or were they stepping forward because suddenly this began happening everywhere?
Suddenly it began happening everywhere, and it got more and more talked about. And the more, pardon the pun, buzz that was created about this happening, the more people realized, wow, this is not a one-off phenomenon. It's a problem.
So when I said this was a slow disappearance of bees, was that accurate? Is slow the right word to use?
Well, it depends on the bees that you're talking about. So with colony collapse disorder, this happened fairly suddenly. And honeybees tend to be the best studied bee species, even though they're not native, because they live in hives that can be manipulated and placed or studied from a laboratory perspective. We know the most about them.
Mm-hmm.
But with other native bee species and other kinds of pollinators, we had been noticing changes.
So there are 200,000 different kinds of pollinators. And you have bumblebees, which are not honeybees, and you have carpenter bees, which are not honeybees, and you have, I would presume that anything that lights on a flower, like a wasp or a yellow jacket, would they be pollinators too?
So technically wasps and yellow jackets can be pollinators, but if you look at them up close, bees, honeybees, bumblebees, other native bee species, their bodies are fuzzy,
mm-hmm.
and that lets the pollen stick to them very well. So a wasp and a hornet and a yellow jacket, those things, if you look at them closely, their bodies, they're sleek. And
yeah.
So the pollen doesn't stick to them as well.
So are we seeing something similar with other kinds of bees disappearing, going away?
We are seeing declines in native bee species. The problem is that we don't know the extent to which we're seeing those declines. And part of that is because, like I just said, honeybees are the easiest to study. They live in a box. You can manipulate them in the lab.
So we've known about this colony collapse since 2006, and it continues because according to Bloomberg, in the period ending in March 2018, a year ago, beekeepers lost 40% of their hives that year, 40%. The year before, a third of the colonies were lost. This clearly is not sustainable. Is the number continuing to grow and grow and grow?
So my guess is, and I haven't seen those particular numbers, but my guess is those were reported winter losses and not colony collapse disorder per se. So colony collapse disorder is not that it's not still a problem, but it's we're seeing it less often. Winter losses or other losses that we're seeing can be from all sorts of things. They could be weak colonies that don't overwinter well. They could be die-offs from things like varroa mites or other pests. They could be pesticide related. So there's all sorts of reasons that you may lose a hive over the winter. We lost all three of ours this winter.
Wow. And I said there are 200,000 species of pollinators, about 100,000 of them. Half of them are in jeopardy. And when I say they're in jeopardy, they're at risk of extinction. Correct?
They're listed as threatened, yes.
What kinds of insects are these? Or not even, they're not just insects. What kinds of, these pollinators that are threatened, who are they? What are they?
Sure. So they're everything from bees, obviously, and butterflies. There's a lot of news about monarch population declines, and they're important pollinators. Hummingbirds, bats, these are all pollinators that are, some are threatened and some are actually.
Why are bats pollinators?
Well, so there's multiple species of bats, and I think the most fun example is the little long-nosed bat. He's called that because he has a very long nose that is perfect for getting into the flower on the agave plant that we use for tequila.
So there's no bat, no tequila.
No bats, no tequila, yes. If there's no other reason you want to save the pollinators, your tequila could be at risk.
So I've just given an illustration of why this is important. It's not just tequila, though. It's the food we eat. How many foods, how many crops are dependent on these pollinators to grow?
So the most off-cited stat is about one out of every three bites of food we eat is dependent on a pollinator. And so it's everything from tequila and coffee and chocolate to more common vegetables like cucumbers and, you know, apples and those kinds of things.
Wow. Tea, chocolate, apples, almonds.
Almonds are big.
All depend on pollinators. So on a sliding scale with these collapsing bee colonies and the disappearance of monarch butterflies and other pollinators, where are we in terms of the foods being harmed by this lack of pollinators? How much in jeopardy, I guess, is the question, is the food supply right now?
So it's hard to say at this moment because commercial beekeepers are responsible for trekking in hives, you know, across the country to places like California for the almond orchards. And so they are having to kind of double down and make sure that there are enough honeybees in these orchards and other fields and places so that bees, so that their crops can be pollinated. So I don't know that we're seeing any hard data on where our food supply is as far as pollinators go, pollinator collapse goes, but certainly in places like China, where their pollinators have been so decimated, their populations, that we've seen areas in China where they're hand pollinating with small paintbrushes in things like apple orchards, which is a place we don't want to get to.
So human beings are going flower to flower,
yes,
and using a paintbrush to take the pollen from one flower and put it on another flower. How do we know what we're doing?
Well, we're not doing it as well as a pollinator could, for sure. And, you know, there have been some experiments with drones and drone pollination. And, you know, they've shown that drones can pollinate, but they don't do it as well and they don't do it as reliably. And you still need a human operator behind that drone. So it's not as an efficient of a process as actual, you know, insect pollination.
When people first noticed the decline in the deaths of whole colonies of bees, when they realized that butterflies, and I noticed this a couple of years ago, but I know when I first moved into the house that I live in now, every summer I'd see all these beautiful monarch butterflies around the backyard, and now they're not there. They're never there. Never. I never see them at all. When we noticed that they were no longer coming around, we did not know why this was happening. Do we know anything more than we knew then?
We do know more, and there have been a few things that have been implicated in monarch decline in particular. One is the loss of milkweed. So milkweed is the host plant for monarch butterflies. They need to lay their eggs on it.
And why do we have less milkweed?
Agriculture is one major reason. So as the farmers' fields have gotten larger, the population of milkweed has gotten smaller. They've lost their habitat. It's no different than any other species when there's a lot of development or natural environments are taken out of their natural environment, whether it's because somebody built a parking deck or somebody put in a field of corn. The population of milkweed declined, and that inhibited the availability of habitat for monarchs.
So we must be talking about great swaths of milkweed, not just a little patch here and there.
Yes, we're talking about great swaths of milkweed.
And this must have happened over a significant amount of time. This just didn't happen overnight, right?
It's not happened overnight, no. But as more and more land gets taken over by agriculture, it's one of the biggest reasons for habitat loss for pollinators is commercial-scale agricultural production. And then along with that, so as these fields have gotten larger, they're also developed things like Roundup-ready corn and soy, which allows farmers to spray their entire fields with herbicides. And as they're spraying their entire fields with herbicides, they're hitting some milkweed that remains. And so we're losing some milkweed to pesticides as well.
So how much milkweed are we talking? Because I like butterflies. How much milkweed are we talking about? And can it be done? Can homeowners who care about butterflies plant milkweed and make up the difference? Or are we talking about a scale that's just not duplicable?
I don't know that anyone has quantified the amount of milkweed that's been lost, but it's a lot. And I think that it's a great idea for homeowners to do what they can to plant milkweed. The really important thing is to plant native milkweed and not
Can you get it at the Home Depot at Lowe's? I mean, do they sell weed? I mean, weeds.
So despite its name, it's not actually a weed. It's a native plant. There are also tropical varieties, and those are the ones that you want to avoid. So I would suggest if you're really keen to plant milkweed, it's important to plant it in places, it's important to purchase it from places where you know it's native. And so I would check with your local extension office. I would check with like the UNCC Botanical Garden, where they can really make good recommendations. They often have plant sales and things.
What's the difference between native and tropical milkweed?
So it's like the difference between native and tropical anything. Native milkweed is a native plant that's evolved to survive well in our habitat, and it's what our monarch population has evolved with. And so tropical milkweed does not provide the same amount of nutrients or as good of a host site for monarchs. It's like saying, you could eat fast food every day and you'd still be getting calories,
right?
Or you could eat fruits and vegetables and you would be getting better calories.
So the threats to these pollinators come from pesticides. They come from a disappearing habitat.
Mm-hmm.
They come from invasive species. They come from climate change.
Correct.
Because as we'll talk about in a second, climate change really affects those far more than we are affected by it. Which is worse of all those things? What's the biggest threat? Do you know? Does anybody know?
I think it's the combination of all of the threats that is really the problem. And the first three are easier to address. Climate change is a little tougher because we can't just turn the thermostat down on the planet.
Jody Helmer is our guest. She's the author of Protecting Pollinators, How to Save the Creatures That Feed Our World. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this because this is actually a threat to us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jody Helmer is with us. She lives here in North Carolina, and she's written this book called Protecting Pollinators, How to Save the Creatures That Feed Our World. And we're talking about how they're in distress because of the 200,000 pollinating species, about 100,000 of them are at risk. And most people who have taken note of what's going on outside their window have noticed that we don't see butterflies like we used to see. We don't see fireflies. I'm not sure that they're pollinators, but we don't see as many fireflies. Are they pollinators? We don't see many fireflies anymore. Not to the degree that we did when I was a kid. And we know the honeybee colony collapse has been a problem that we've known about for years. Is the decline in the honeybee population from different causes than the decline in the hummingbird or the butterfly population?
So the overall causes of decline fall into those categories, those buckets that you mentioned earlier: habitat loss, pesticide use, invasive species, and climate change. Honeybees are under some additional pressure from pests. Varroa mites in particular are really aggressive, and they've wiped out a lot of colonies.
And how do we know they're in decline as opposed to just moving someplace else? They pack their bags and went someplace else, because honeybees don't need these artificial honeycombs that beekeepers make. They can be in trees and other places. How do we know they just haven't gone someplace else?
Mostly because most of our honeybee populations are managed species. So some people have compared them to livestock. So it would be like you're raising a bunch of pigs and they disappear. You'd know if they went somewhere else. They need to stay home. And so these honeybees are these managed
species.
But pigs
are noticeable. They're large animals. These are little teeny insects.
This is true. They are little teeny insects. Because they're a managed species, beekeepers spend a lot of time in their hives. So we do regular inspections. We're looking for problems. We're identifying issues. And so if they were just taking off and going somewhere else, they wanted to move.
But there are no butterfly keepers. So how do we know the butterflies simply haven't, because of climate change, for instance, haven't simply changed their migratory patterns?
So we do know that has happened and is happening with a lot of pollinator species. So monarch butterflies are perhaps one of the best studied butterflies because they have this incredible migration pattern. And because we have monitored their migration pattern for years, and they tend to go back to the same actual trees year after year.
We know that?
We know that.
How do we know that?
Because they've been well studied. So they...
But I mean, we tag them?
We don't tag them. Well, so... The migratory journey takes four generations of butterflies. So the butterfly that leaves the East Coast and travels down to Mexico and comes back, those are not the same. It's not mama butterfly making that whole trip and coming back. It's four generations of butterflies.
It's great-great-great-grandchild butterfly.
Correct. Yeah. But we know where they end up in Mexico. We know exactly where their overwintering grounds are, and so we can study the populations there quite well. In other species that are not as well studied, We have seen noticeable changes in their habitat. So because of a warming climate, they're shifting northward, and that has been documented. And that's happening with bats and hummingbirds as well.
So if they go to the same tree that their great-grandparents went to when they began the migratory pattern, and climate change has made that tree less attractive, perhaps, how do they choose a new habitat? Because those trees may not exist where the climate is favorable now.
That's exactly part of the problem, is that they are not going as far south, so they're not going to the same overwintering grounds because it's gotten too hot. So they're having to find other places that may be less ideal to overwinter. And when they do that, not only is their habitat less ideal, but there also is increased competition with other species that have evolved to that particular space, and now they're having to share it with the monarchs that aren't going as far.
So beekeepers have noticed this problem when it comes to the honeybees. Anecdotally, we know it. Scientists know about the butterflies and other pollinators. Farmers certainly are concerned about this because their crops are at risk. How would you describe the concern of policymakers?
It so depends on the policymaker. You know, Obama did some good things to try to create habitat and pass legislation through the Farm Bill that promoted things like the Conservation Reserve Program that encouraged farmers to set aside agricultural land in conservation, which included planting of pollinator strips. And so that kind of legislation has been happening, but we're not seeing large-scale policy change to protect pollinators.
Can there be large-scale policy change? I mean, what would it be?
It would have to be things like, it could be things like pesticide reduction, which we've seen, or pesticide bans, which we've seen in places like Europe and Canada.
Okay.
It could be conservation reserve programs where we're setting aside habitat.
On the one hand, farmers are dependent on pollinators for certain crops to do well. So they want these pollinators to be healthy and prolific. On the other hand, you say that agriculture is one of the biggest threats to pollinators. This is kind of ironic. Why is that?
Well, so the large commercial-scale farms that grow crops like corn and wheat and soy are not dependent on pollinators. Those are all wind-pollinated crops, so they do just fine without pollinators. It's the smaller farmers that are growing more diverse crops, fruits and vegetables in particular. I would say almond growers are the one exception to that rule because they have wide swaths of land that are in production and they do require pollinator species. So the farms that are taking over huge expanses of land are not the farms that are reliant on pollinators. So there's less of a impetus for them to protect them.
But those farmers who are dependent on pollinators, you write that you are impressed by their commitment to trying to do something about this.
Yeah, I think that agriculture is not only one of the biggest problems for pollinators, but also presents one of the biggest opportunities for pollinators. So even some of these farmers that are growing wind-pollinated crops do care, and they are taking precautions to make sure that there's habitat or that they're spraying appropriately.
So they're actually altering what they're doing, and they're trying to set aside areas perhaps that for milkweed and things like that. Are they doing that?
Yep.
And does that affect them drastically economically? I mean, is it a hardship for them to do that?
No, for a couple of reasons. One, because the Farm Bill pays them to put some of their land in the Conservation Reserve Program. So there's land incentives for that. And then a lot of the land that they are putting in, where they're putting in pollinator strips and other forms of habitat, is land that they couldn't otherwise use. So it's corners of fields that big tractors can't get into, or pivot irrigation can't access. So they're really not good cropland anyway.
Even people who don't keep beehives and don't like bees because they sting and they're pesky when you're having a picnic or trying to sit on your deck and have dinner, people like honey. So they appreciate the value of the honeybees. They appreciate the beauty that butterflies bring them and that hummingbirds bring them. But there are other less attractive pollinators, bats for one, because I know that you suggest people put bat houses in their yards.
Yes.
No way, Jose, is what I would say to that. But why should I do that?
Well, because bats are a threatened pollinator species. And I know there's a lot of concern. Bats are rabid. You know, you'll end up getting rabies, or your dog will get rabies. But they really, you know, they deserve some love too. They may not be the most attractive. Depends on who you ask. They may not be the most attractive pollinator species, but they are an important pollinator species. And so we need to do what we can to protect them.
What other pollinator species might not be in the realm of well-liked or even well-known pollinators that we should be looking out for?
I would say most of the moth species that we probably don't give a second thought to are good pollinators, that they're just unattractive. They don't have the great coloration of monarchs and other butterflies. So the homely hawk moth, for example, doesn't get a lot of love, but we need to keep it around.
And how seriously threatened are hummingbirds?
We're seeing some shifts in their migratory behavior. We're seeing some reductions in their population, and we're seeing some impacts from pesticides. So they're definitely a species in peril.
So I happen to be plagued, this is a personal question now, with carpenter bees. They're eating my deck alive. And I used to go out back in, because of your book, I've stopped doing this now, but I used to go out back with a tennis racket and just knock them down. And I stopped doing that because they're pollinators.
They are.
So we should just let them bore into our houses and have a good old time. Because they come back from wherever they go laden with pollen. I mean, they're covered with it.
Yeah, I would say carpenter bees are the number one question that I get from homeowners because people have that problem.
Yeah,
they are important pollinators. They're very benign bees from a...
They don't sting.
They're not going to bug you necessarily,
right.
But no. They will tear up your house. So you can try something like an insect hotel, which has wood in it. It looks a little like a birdhouse, and it has wood in it that they're supposed to bore into. It's safe space for them to live. But the reality is they don't have a lot of spots, and so your deck looks particularly attractive to them in a nice urban environment.
Well, good luck to them. They're doing well, I can tell you that. Steve emails, my wife and I attempted to keep bees a few years ago. The thing that forced us to quit was the neighbors spraying for mosquitoes. Everyone should be aware that when they spray their yards for mosquitoes, they kill all insects and they kill everything in the surrounding yards. Is that true?
It's true. So what they're spraying is insecticide,
right?
And bees are insects, and so it's an issue. We're fairly sure that all three hives that we lost this year were lost when the farmer adjacent to us sprayed.
So is there a particular insecticide that you should never use or you should not spray? You should only use for localized treatment for certain things?
So when it comes to impacts on bees, neonicotinoids are the most implicated insecticide. But the reality is that any insecticide you spray is going to have some additional effect. You can't just spray.
And what product contains neonicotinoids? You know?
There are so many of them.
Okay.
Yeah. There,
but they're name brands that we know and love and would recognize on the store shelf?
Yes.
And we shouldn't be buying them?
I'm not going to say you shouldn't buy them. I think it depends on who you are. I think as a regular residential user, products that are going to kill a lot of things, whether they're weeds or insects, you probably don't really need.
And if you look on the label of these products, will it say neonicotinoid, or is there a variety of those?
There's a variety of them.
So you have to look for the name.
Terribly hard to pronounce,
okay.
To be honest. But they will be listed on the label. And really, the reality is any insecticide you buy, you should not buy. As a regular homeowner, because you're not just spraying a single mosquito. I mean, you're having to kind of take a DDT approach, right, to your yard. You're kind of bombing the yard if you're trying to get rid of mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way to avoid collateral damage when you're doing that.
And if you're keeping bats as pollinators, you're depriving them of a food source.
I'm just saying, if you kept bats, you would have fewer mosquitoes if you put up some bat houses.
Okay.
Yes.
We have a lot of gardeners here and elsewhere around the world, and many of them plant flowers that are pretty, and some of them don't come from around these parts.
Mm-hmm.
You stress the importance of planting native plants.
Right.
Why?
So native plants have evolved in our area, co-evolved with pollinators in our area. So they really are the best food and habitat for pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to dissuade anybody from planting a garden. It's a really important thing. And so whether you plant a native plant or you're planting something like a petunia, that has value to pollinators for sure. But when you're looking at things like perennials in particular or large landscape plantings, you need to be thinking about native plants because they just do provide the best resources for our pollinators.
You're not the only person who's been on this program that says that. I mean, everybody stresses the importance of not planting non-native plants for
mm-hmm.
that very reason. Jody Helmer's our guest. She's the author of Protecting Pollinators, How to Save the Creatures, that Feed Our World. There appear to be several different ways that climate change is impacting pollinators. One thing is that spring is arriving earlier, and we like it. Human beings like it. Get out of that frosty cold, but not so good for the creatures that we're talking about, because insects who thrive as plants bloom, may not be here in time, is what you're saying. They're not as in tune, or maybe they're too in tune, and they arrive here, and the plants that they depend on are not in bloom yet, or have already bloomed and are no longer blooming, and that's causing great stress.
Yes. So there are a couple of issues with climate change. One is that species, as we talked about earlier, are moving farther north. And as they're changing their habitat or changing their location, the habitat may not be as ideal for them.
Why haven't they caught up? I mean, if it's getting warmer here and these insects are coming from the south and they're moving north as it gets warmer in the summertime, in the springtime and summertime, why? Because I'm going to talk about this. You write that even these small creatures notice even tiny changes in our temperature. Why aren't they then saying, oh, it's warm? It's only April. I shouldn't be there till May, but it's warm. Let's go. Why aren't they saying that to themselves?
Well, so pollinators and plants use different cues about their emergence. So they may use a daylight cue. In other words, they wait for the time change to know that it's either time to hatch or emerge from hibernation, or for plants that it's time to bloom. Or they may use a temperature cue. And so as the temperature gets to a certain point, then they need to make a move or they need to emerge. And if those cues are mismatched, then there's as you said, the pollinator may emerge, but the plant's not yet ready.
Right.
Or the plant may emerge and the pollinator's not yet ready. And so when the pollinator comes out, the plant has already stopped blooming.
And these cycles have developed over millennia, literally, because you write that small changes in temperature are really things that we wouldn't even notice.
Right.
They notice. Mm-hmm. Spring is arriving 2.3 days per decade earlier over the past century. That's a lot over a century. That's a big shift in the arrival of spring. And that's been impacting flowering dates. But because these insects are impacted also by light, the light cycles aren't changing.
Correct.
So they don't know what to do. That's what the problem is.
Yeah. So it's called phenological mismatch.
So they will never get back in sync.
Nope. If we keep seeing the temperatures shift and spring keep arriving earlier, there's going to continue to be a mismatch, and that's going to continue to be a problem.
And you said that it appears that insect-pollinated plants react more strongly to the warming climate than self-pollinating plants. So that puts the focus on these insects.
Mm-hmm.
And we are really screwing with them.
We are. Yeah.
Wow. A lot more questions. We're going to come back and talk more about the pollinators and the challenges they face in the next few minutes with Jody Helmer, Protecting Pollinators, How to Save the Creatures That Feed Our World. And we'll take some of your questions because we're getting a lot of emails from listeners as they listen. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Protecting Pollinators is the name of this discussion and the name of the book that Jody Helmer wrote, How to Save the Creatures That Feed Our World. They are in distress. About half of them around the world are in distress, and that puts our food supply in jeopardy to a great degree. I think you said a third of the food is dependent on these insects that and other creatures that pollinate the food supply. Beekeepers such as yourself have become very important to modern agriculture because some of them take their hives around the country, particularly to orchards around the country, to apple orchards and almond orchards, and they go from place to place as the temperature arrives at the right time, and they release their bees and help pollinate those plants. You write that critics warn that domesticated honeybees are detrimental to wild pollinators. Why? You're helping these farmers with their crops. Why is that a threat?
Well, it's a threat because as the honeybees move in, they take resources from the native bee population. So if you think about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of bees in these hives and almond orchards, they get the food before the native bees.
So why do we care? I don't mean to be callous, but obviously if there's a need for beekeepers to bring hives to these massive orchards that are part of the industrial farming complex, and they're doing their job, do we care about the native pollinators?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because they're native pollinators. I mean, they've evolved
But there are not enough of them to do the job that the honeybees do, that the farmers hire, essentially?
So that's a two-pronged issue. One is, yes, there are not enough of them. But the second is what you just said. It's this industrial food complex where we've got an unsustainable level of pollination that needs to be done that the native bees can't step up to do. However, in places where the native bee populations are strong, they can actually fulfill the pollination need. And there's one story in the book. I interviewed somebody from Cascadian Farm up in Washington State, and they planted a good deal of pollinator habitat around their blueberry fields. And what they realized was that their native population, the native bee population, had come back so strong that they no longer had to bring in hives for rent, that the native bee species were doing the job. And so if we give them the opportunity, because we're supporting their populations, they can step up to the plate.
Yeah, it would seem to me that if you have an orchard, a massive orchard that flowers, that's going to be attractive to native pollinators. How long does it take for the population, though, of native pollinators to catch up to the need the farmers have for pollination?
I think in places like almond orchards where there's just so much pollination that needs to be done, the native bee species can't do it all. Mm-hmm. The problem that the critics bring up is that when you bring in all of these bees, it takes away resources from the native pollinators, and that hurts the population further.
Well, this whole thing is an issue of balance, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know how to do that because
we're
not smart enough to know how to do that.
Right. Our food system has evolved in a way that is not sustainable with our natural ecosystem.
So are we, because there's a push now to get away from beef and other animals because they, methane gas and their contribution to climate change, et cetera, and to move us toward other crops like more vegetarian diets and almonds because they supply protein. Well, can that be done? I mean, you're talking about damage to the native bees because to do it on the scale we need to have it done requires rented bees, essentially, which hurt the native species, and the rented bees are going through colony collapse. Can we do this?
So I think when people talk about that kind of whole-scale food system change and moving towards more vegetarian diets, they're not envisioning 5,000 acres of tomatoes, for example, the way we would see 5,000 acres of corn. And the majority of our corn in this country is grown for animal feed. So it would be a different kind of system. These would be much smaller, much more diverse farms. And could the pollinators keep up with that? Potentially, if we supported them in the right way. But it would create other issues in our food system, like issues of affordability and access.
I was surprised in your book to find out another threat to pollinators is the wall that President Trump says he wants to build along the southern border. And my first reaction to that was, well, we're talking about bees and insects. They can just fly over the wall. ICE is not stopping them. So why is the wall a problem for these pollinators?
So that's an interesting question. I stumbled across this study by accident. There's an academic that was doing the research on the wall, and I happened to come across it in my research. And I called him, and I said, well, I don't understand what the issue is. And he said, well, there's a couple of issues. So first of all, when you think about the wall and the plan for the wall, the vegetation is stripped for huge sections on either side of the wall. So
how big is that? How big is huge? Couple hundred yards or
more, okay. Right? Like, and it depends on the area that we're talking about, what's already there, you know, vegetation wise. But the wall is going through a butterfly sanctuary in Texas, and they've been fighting back against that, the proposed trajectory for the wall. And so they'll lose a lot of habitat. So it's not just that there's great habitat right up to the wall, they're stripping away, you know, hundreds and hundreds of feet on either side of the wall of habitat. Okay. The other issue is that the wall has lights, right? There are lights around the wall, you know, think Friday night lights at the football stadium. And lights of that magnitude will burn up pollinators, these tiny insects, assuming that they could even get up high enough to get over the wall. And that's another issue is that, you know, they don't tend to fly super high in the air.
So literally the heat from the lights will burn
the heat from the lights will burn up the pollinators is one of the concerns. The smaller insect pollinators, yes. And then they can't fly over it.
On the other hand, you write, the government is backing cost-sharing programs to restore habitat. Where? How much money are they spending on this? Who's benefiting? How are they doing it?
So this is primarily through the Farm Bill, through the Conservation Reserve Program that we talked about. So there are incentives for farmers to access funding, cost-share funding, to plant habitat in these unused areas of their fields to put them into conservation.
When I was a kid, you could drive anywhere on a summer night, and the result of that would be bugs all over your windshield, all over your headlights, trapped in the grill of your car. Mm-hmm. Big bugs. That doesn't happen anymore. And there was an article, a long article in the New York Times Sunday magazine several weeks ago about this, because it's not just happening here. It's happening all over the world. Mm-hmm. There are no bugs. Is that part of this problem?
Are those bugs pollinators? Is that what you're asking?
I don't know. I mean, is that part of the problem? If I don't know what these bugs were that got trapped in the headlights. All I knew is it was my job to wash the car, and it was it was yucky.
Right.
So that doesn't happen anymore. And if that doesn't happen anymore all over the world, what is that saying to us?
Well, I think that our ecosystem has changed to the point that we're just not seeing the bugs that we used to see. You know,
they don't exist.
I don't know if they don't exist. I've not seen any data on that. But, you know, we're developing. We have more urban environments. We have more light pollution. We have environments that are less attractive to bugs, including pollinators, insect pollinators.
But are all bugs to a certain degree pollinators? Even if they don't? No, really?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
I mean, any creature that has pollen that sticks to it, that moves pollen around,
right.
I guess you could call a pollinator, but it's not what we would think of as a pollination is not its primary motivation or role.
So Rachel on Facebook writes, what about, and we've kind of addressed this to a certain degree, but what about yellow jackets, which seem almost invasive and a pest? Should we try and save them and not call an exterminator? And hornets, are they worth saving?
So I think that every creature is worth saving and plays some role in our ecosystem.
Because we don't really know what role they always play, correct?
We don't always know what role they play. And I agree with Rachel that hornets and yellow jackets and wasps are pesty. But there's very little way that you can kill them without causing collateral damage. And that's the bigger issue, is you're not just having an impact on that species, you're having a ripple effect on other species.
Now, yellow jackets are pesty because they like to fly around food and sit on soda cans, and people have been bitten because they drink out of a soda can and the thing is down inside. But you work with honeybees. They, too, sting. What's the difference? Since you're around stinging animals all the time, what's the difference?
So I think that when you work the bees, which is what it's called when you go into your hive, when you work the bees well, they're less likely to sting. So one of the things you may have seen beekeepers do is smoke the hives, and that causes the bees to kind of calm down. You work the hive from the back and not the front. I mean, there are certain things you do to kind of avoid being stung. They don't want to sting you, but it's like if I backed you into a corner in the studio and was very threatening toward you and was much larger than you, you would probably feel the need to maybe strike back in some way.
Yeah.
And bees are very much the same. I will also say that a bee sting is far different than a yellow jacket sting. It hurts for a moment and then it's done. It's like getting a needle at the doctor's office, whereas a yellow jacket, that thing stays with you and hurts for a long time. So the stinging is just different.
Brian on Facebook, I'll get to Brian's question in a second because it's a good question to go out on. But Stephen on Twitter, wouldn't it be helpful to plant or seed milkweed, pollinator-friendly wildflowers along highways and greenways instead of grass? And there are some interstates in this area that do plant wildflowers. Mm-hmm. Is that helpful? Or is it dangerous to the insects? Because if they see it and they fly to it and they fly out, they're not looking where they're going, they're going to get hit by a car.
Right. It's actually very valuable.
Okay.
So someone at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center in Austin, Texas, I asked a very similar question of during my interview, and she said, you have to think of habitat like a quilt, and if every one of us took care of our own little quilt square, then they would have a whole quilt of habitat to move through as they're moving around, say, Charlotte. And so those habitat strips along highways are actually really important. And yes, we're going to lose some insects to, you know, the windshield, but...
But not many, from what I can tell these days.
Not many, yes.
Andy emails, I help manage a conserved property in Gaston County that includes a four-acre utility right-of-way. 5 years ago, we made one change that has transformed the property. We switched from mowing the area twice a year to once a year in late February. Small populations of coreopsis, spotted bee balm, sunflowers, and goldenrod have exploded with just this minor management change. As a result, this area has become a haven for native flowering plants, insects, and birds. And you've been nodding through all of this.
Yeah. First of all, congratulations for doing that. It's big. And it's important. Those small management changes can be huge. And as homeowners, if you just waited a little extra time to mow your grass and let that clover pop up and let those dandelions come up.
What?
Absolutely. We're so obsessed with lush green lawns. But if we actually all did that, it would provide really important food for pollinators.
Because bumblebees love clover.
Bumblebees love clover. And it's one of the first foods that emerges for them every season.
Okay. Elizabeth on Facebook, what natural weed killers do you recommend? I have a native garden and end up pulling weeds by hand, but it can be overwhelming.
First of all, good on pulling weeds by hand. It's actually the best way to go, but I understand that it's completely overwhelming. You can use a vinegar-based solution to kill weeds naturally. Vinegar and baking soda will actually do the job with a little bit of water.
That won't kill the plants around it?
Nope.
Just the weeds?
You have to spray pretty carefully right on the weeds.
Okay.
You can't just mass spray the entire garden. You have to hit the weeds, but that'll do the trick.
And Brian on Facebook, let me get to his question because it's an important one. How can an average homeowner like myself help the bee population? Because you write in the book about the role citizen scientists play in all of this.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I think that, first of all, realize that you do have the power to impact the pollinator population. You can plant habitat, as we talked about. You can remove invasive species from your habitat. That's really important. You can stop using pesticides and weed killers, herbicides.
Give me some examples of invasive species.
Kudzu is huge for us. And so when you think about the way kudzu grows, it crowds out everything else, including native plants, and it provides no good habitat or food for a pollinator species. So removing kudzu is big. And then, yeah, getting engaged in a citizen science project. There are lots of opportunities depending on what your fascination is, to get involved with monarch butterflies or bats or bees and help scientists develop data sets so that we have better understandings of what's happening to these species, and that will help inform policy and management decisions.
So on the one hand, you're talking about the important role that citizen scientists can play in all this, and that if you don't want to be a citizen scientist, just what you can do to make your yard more friendly and less dangerous for these pollinators. On the other hand, you said that amateur beekeepers can do more harm than good.
True story.
Well, what about citizen scientists? Can't they do more harm than good?
No, because with citizen science, you're just counting.
Okay.
You're just observing. You're not touching.
What are amateur beekeepers doing that's harmful?
So one of the trends that we're seeing with amateur beekeepers is the desire to be a treatment-free beekeeper. In other words, they have this belief that you just put the bees in the hive and you let them do their thing, they know what they're doing, and you don't go in and you don't treat them at all.
Right.
And what's happening is when they develop issues, they can spread them to the native bee populations. And so that puts, A, the native bee populations at risk. It also puts other beehives or beekeepers' hives in the vicinity at risk. And so that can be problematic.
And I only have a short amount of time here, but you've also suggested in your yard to create mulch-free zones. Why?
Yes. So most native bee species are ground nesting. And if you think about the size of a bee and the size of a piece of mulch, they just can't shift it aside to get into the ground to nest. So if you create some mulch-free zones, you give them a safe space for nesting.
Jody Helmer, her book is called Protecting Pollinators, How to Save the Creatures That Feed Our World. It's very interesting and scary. But thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.